everybody. Welcome to the first episode of Presence. It is a podcast about virtual reality and the people creating it. I am Jason Evangelo, and I'm joined by prolific games journalist Joseph Noop.
Monolithic even. Yeah.
Okay, so you have written for Playboy, IGN. Give us the list. Where can we find your work?
Most prominent work at Playboy is actually where I got essentially my start just a little under a year ago. And then since then, I have written for PC Gamer, interned at Game Informer, and been most recently doing some stuff for Upload VR, one of those two major VR sites out there right now for your viewing pleasure. And that's as far as the professional stuff. There's plenty more in terms of stuff I did in college, but I guess we will be delving that into that in the general episode, correct, Jason?
Yeah, definitely. And I have questions for you guys too, but first I want to introduce our special guest, my friend and the author of Console Wars, Blake J. Harris.
Thanks for having me. I'm so delighted to be the first guest.
Well, it's a great fit. I mean, you got on my radar after I had read, I don't think we knew each other personally until after I had read Console Wars, and I just kept promoting that book like to the heavens because it's a fantastic, like, it almost reads like a thriller, but a nonfiction thriller about the 16-bit console wars between Sega and Nintendo.
Yeah, I mean, that was very intentional. And I mean, first off, of course, how are we not going to become friends? You were so kind of saying nice things about the book, and I spent 3 years on it, but it was like a thriller to the people who lived it. So I really just wanted to capture that in the story, and kind of as a segue into why I'm on this episode and why we're talking about virtual reality is I distinctly remember after I finished Console Wars, which was about Sega, Nintendo, this really important time in my life, and I suspect your guys as well. And I remember telling my agent that it was really sad that I was never going to write a book as good as Console Wars, not because of talent, I hoped that I would continue to get better at writing, but I just thought there would never be anything that affected a culture that had such pop cultural relevance, that had such technological marvel and schoolyard fights and just such a big impact as Sega and Nintendo, or that I wouldn't be lucky enough to kind of have access to such a story. And then as we'll get into later on, I had my first VR experience and I realized that I was very, very wrong, and that this is going to be, in my opinion, as big or bigger than that Sega Nintendo battle and change our culture in all sorts of ways.
I think that's honestly the most fascinating element of this new book to me is there's been game history books, and it's always been a look backward, and you can kind of date each one by saying, oh, well, this one's regarding the PS2 as the pinnacle thus far of technology and presentation, but we've all got an opportunity to not only like look back on the last, maybe I would assume kind of a decade or so of VR technology, but also what it means for going on what it's going to be like the next 100 years worth of technology that this year in VR will influence, right?
Yeah, and I mean, that makes my job very scary, to be writing a book.
He was wrong.
No, I mean, it makes it exciting, but it's very different when I'm pitching a book, Console Wars, and I know I can tell you the beginning, middle, and end, and everything.
That isn't changing anytime soon, yeah.
And this time, I don't know what the end will be, I know that there won't be an ending. But kind of the reason that I wanted to do it now and not do it 20 years from now, or not do it reflectively like so much of history, is that I felt, one, that it was world-changing and important, and two, and kind of like the first thing that my first pitch to Palmer when I mentioned I wanted to do the book, and obviously I'd want to interview him, was that when these headsets come out, I think that early adopters will be ready. I said player one will be ready, but players two through mom, they're going to think this is some far-fetched sci-fi thing that has nothing to do with them. And I wanted to put a human face on the story so that my mom or my grandma, would give VR a chance and realize that it could actually help connect the two of us, or that there was lots of things that they could enjoy in there. So it's definitely a unique challenge to be writing about something as it's happening. But I think that this is a story that's worth doing that for. And I'll, you know, plus on a personal level, it's nice to not have to ask people to recall things from 20 years ago, but to actually have documentation and, you know, someone could just recall it very vividly.
Well, you know, kind of a tradition that we want to establish here on Presence is asking our guests and also myself and Joe, what your first – not what your first VR experience was, but the first VR experience you had that was kind of that aha moment, that eye-opener, that oh my god, jaw to the floor experience. What was yours, Blake?
Well – it's a great question. I'm glad that you guys are going to ask everyone on the show because I don't know anyone who doesn't have it. I don't know any other product where you're going to get that 100% jaw drop moment or at least 99% or whatever. And so for me, you know, I tried DK1 at E3 a couple of years back and I saw proof of concept that, all right, this is really cool. This is worth, you know, this is going to happen. But for me, the, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening now moment was, watching Clouds Over Sidra on the Samsung, the Innovators Edition of the Gear VR. I was writing a story for Fast Company about how the UN was working with Verse to create these short films for fundraising purposes and also for decision making and you know, making these films about a refugee camp in Jordan or other films, you know, instead of telling people. And instead of showing people, which was always the preferred thing for a writer, now you're actually bringing people there. And I remember feeling like I was there, of course, but the thing that I was so struck by, well, there's two things. One was that I remember thinking that, while I was standing in a park across the street from the UN with this headset on, I remember thinking, if someone were to kind of punch me in my stomach right now, I probably wouldn't even notice because I don't feel like I'm in the present world. And then the other thing was, as a Harry Potter fan, of both the books and the movies, I remember thinking that it felt like I was inside of the Penn seat, like I was inside of someone else's memory. It felt exactly like that. And, you know, what was so marvelous to me was not the, you know, the story, I guess, that I was being told, like sort of the central focus, but that you could look around and you could focus on tertiary characters and things that you weren't quote unquote supposed to be looking at. And that those were, you know, stuff was happening because it was real life and it was a real memory.
All right, Joe, how about your first really impactful VR experience?
Well, you know, my first time with VR was actually at last year's GDC 2015. And I think it was just a simple for some reason, the Eve Valkyrie team or it might have even been Elite Dangerous. Those things run together for me. So quickly, it seems. One of those teams had just two stations outside of their general show floor booth, and just me and two other journalist friends were kind of there taking turns on it, and it wasn't perfect, and this was clear a year ago, so obviously some advances had been made, but it was a demo in which you were just placed into the seat of this kind of middle-tier fighter ship, and the developer who was kind of guiding me through it all beforehand was saying, you know, there's just this one other ship that you're hunting. Go find them in the middle of this asteroid belt and do your thing. And here's – and it was with a flight stick as well, so it wasn't like an Xbox One controller or anything like that. And that really captured the essence of what VR was for me. But I think even though that sold me, I think – what really, really kind of solidified my enthusiasm and even my enthusiasm for joining such a podcast like this was being able to go to this year's GDC and just seeing the multitude of things. So I think the first VR demo I played at this year's GDC was Chronos by the Gunfire Games team, I believe is what they are. They are the ones who did Darksiders 1 and 2 and then various ports of other games. But I was stunned to see just how well it worked, not just in like a cockpit game, because that was really my only familiarity with, you know, a personal experience with VR. But the Chronos, for those who don't know, is kind of just this third-person action adventure. I call it Ico meets Dark Souls Light, not to, you know, diminish.
Pretty accurate, actually.
Right. One of my friends earlier was like, wait, Ico, Echo, do you mean the dolphin video game? And I was like, no. So, but what was interesting about that was, instead of a cockpit view or instead of a first person view, kind of a semi-traditional third person view, but with a Resident Evil, style, old school Resident Evil camera system where you enter a new room and it kind of takes a different perspective, up, down, left, right, you know, and it just created this incredible sense of like, you know, the titular podcast presence. The camera might be resting on top of a couple of like wine barrels in a cellar, and it almost feels like I'm a cat perched up there watching my hero, you know, walk on by. And, I think the biggest aha moment of that particular demo was, and Jason, I know you experienced this too. The developer mm-hmm. has you walk up or climb up a ladder to go hit some random switch, and he says, you know, stop here and let's take a moment to take in this environment. Look to your right and look over to my right, just a sea of shadows with two beady eyes looking back at you. And that for me was what the Dark Souls light element came into, of the environment isn't springing anything on you, but if you're not paying attention, you're going to have to deal with the consequences. And that was that perfect encapsulation of, well, Kronos is doing this cool third person VR experience where like my eyesight is divorced from the character in a really unique way. I don't have to look at my character. I can engage with the environment in ways that no other third person action adventure game has previously. Yep.
Yeah, and I love how that approach still gives the directors full control over the artistic direction of each scene.
Exactly.
You know, the camera placement of each scene while still letting you feel really immersed in that environment. It's really neat.
You talk to like narrative designers or just visual designers, and they talk about, well, when a player enters a new area, you know, there's some companies that are just brilliant at really naturally guiding a player's point of view, before they walk into a new area, and they say like, okay, clearly my instinct is to go walk towards that light or, over something into the distance. And, this just seemed like the natural evolution of that. It's hearkening back to that Resident Evil fixed angle, but they turn what on any traditional console would have been a boring experience into something fascinating.
So mine, to give you a proper perspective, I have to actually go back and tell you about my bad experience with the Oculus Rift. The bad experience was at E3 2013. And we're talking, I don't even know if this was the DK2 yet. I think it was still the DK1, the first development kit. I mean, it was the one that was, you know, all duct taped with foam on it. I mean, it was a far cry from what we have this week available to the public. And I don't remember the exact demo that I experienced at that CES in 2013, but I know that it took me 3 minutes for sim sickness to set in. And I know that my stomach threatened a very messy revolt if I didn't get out of there. And so I went into CES 2014 feeling a little bit anxious, a little bit skeptical. I'd heard that they were going to be demonstrating the Crystal Cove prototype, which had a smattering of new features, you know, head tracking and drastically reduced latency. And I mean, it was almost a completely different product. And so they put it on, and the first demo they show me was, I don't even know what it was called. It was just a tech demo by Epic. And it was sort of to demonstrate a tower defense game. I don't know if you remember this, but it was really,
was there a title
remembered
for it?
I don't even remember the title. There probably was, but it was just the tech demo. Mm-hmm. And I just remember instantly leaning in and looking behind this huge column and kind of seeing an ogre marching out, and I just kind of wanted to flick him. Like, I felt like I could just flick him off of the walkway and into the lava that was below. And it took all of 5 seconds to feel like I was completely present in that world. And then they put me into Eve Valkyrie. And this was the first time that I had experienced Eve Valkyrie and I was just, it's really hard to describe still. The being able to just super accurately target these enemy spaceships with just your sight and feeling instantly like you're in that cockpit and like you're zooming around in space and, you know, it was so hard to describe. And, you know, virtual reality, that is one of its biggest obstacles, is because you can't really understand it until you experience it. But it was the Epic demo and the Eve Valkyrie demo that just put me head over heels in love. I bought a DK2. Then, you know, the next day I pre-ordered the DK2. And I was just hooked. And, you know, something that I should have said this at the top of the show, but our podcast is called Presence. And presence is a super important aspect of virtual reality. It basically is feeling physically present in a world that isn't physical.
That is essentially that all encapsulating term for the power of VR, right? Is, you can't describe being in certain places. I've written stories before where maybe someone might compliment me on, the way I described like a city street or something, and they'll say, "Oh, I live in Miami, but, the way you described this winter scene, made me feel like this one particular street in Miami I always walked down had a lot of snow falling down on it." And I was like, that's kind of awkward and amazing all at the same time. It's like, that's not even a real thing that happens in Miami, but, it's that feeling of, now you finally know, and there is no way to know prior to that.
One interesting thing that I noticed at GDC, and one of my followers on Twitter pointed this out. He said, "You use a lot of physical descriptors like heavy or dank, but VR doesn't do that, does it? I mean, you're not picking anything up. So why are you using so many physical descriptions? In the end, VR is only visual, but you speak like you actually felt it." And I simply told him, "I think you've answered your own question." Once your brain believes it, it actively starts filling in these gaps.
I saw when you initially posted that little conversation thread, and my initial impression was, okay, that's either a person who has almost zero familiarity with VR or is a kid, because they're using that perspective of like, well, you're using all these crazy wacky terms for this new technology. They are answering their own question of, yeah, we're describing what it feels like to, you know, experience an explosion in VR or to be in a battle in VR, because we feel like we are, and it's blowing our minds at the same time. We can't process it.
Guys, so we are going to get into one of our regular segments of Presence, and we're going to have a few of those. They may change a little bit, but we kind of want you to expect a few reliable segments every week. So we're going to have Refresh Rate, which kind of covers the week's most meaningful news stories in the VR world. And every week we will also have Field of View. And that's basically going to be a roundtable discussion about one important topic between myself, Joe, and whoever we have on as a guest. And then at the end of the show, we'll have some listener questions. And right now, we don't have a dedicated Twitter set up, but you can follow me at KillYourFM on Twitter.
And you can follow me at Joseph Knoop. That's JosephKnoop.
And if we don't get to your questions this week or the next week, we're rolling them forward to each new episode. So we will get to them eventually. We do promise that.
We had a really good turnout for questions. So by all means, if something new comes up every week, or you just want to reiterate a question that might still be topical a week or two later, by all means, keep sending it.
All right. So, yeah, the biggest news this week, obviously, is the launch, the retail actual consumer launch of the Oculus Rift VR headset. It launched on Monday. I don't know what date that is. I'm going to say Monday the 28th.
Yes.
Correct.
At least that's when the initial batch of pre-orders were shipped out to both Kickstarter backers and I think a few, you know, a few pre-order customers. It's $5.99. It comes with the headset. It comes with a sensor for tracking the headset. It comes with an Xbox One controller and a wireless dongle and all the cables that you need to play. And a rather excellent software setup, too. Very, very elegant software setup, like completely covers all the bases. Won't let you progress if you need to update your video card. Won't let you progress if, you know, you haven't connected your Xbox One controller. It's really, really intuitive and really easy to follow. However, and we're going to touch on this, at length in Field of View, but it's a little bit of a soft launch.
Is it a launch at all?
Is it a launch at all?
When you think of the word launch, you think of, you know, a rocket shooting into space and achieving something grand. This is more like the Sputnik kind of just fizzling out a little bit.
I don't know, though. I mean, I know we'll talk about it more, but I think that the rocket launch is kind of
the fact that it's happening.
Yeah. The fact that we launched a rocket into space, and maybe that means 50 people say, oh, now I want to launch a rocket. And they won't get you for some amount of time, but you know, I think the guys at Houston/actually in Florida are pretty psyched that they were able to launch the rocket into space. And, I mean, we'll talk about it more.
Yeah. I mean, what do we want to actually, cover as newsy wise, Joe? What do you think?
Well, I think, we can talk at some length about the games, but that might be encapsulated by the grander launch discussion. But, I think maybe the most pertinent news thing is, at least we can touch upon this briefly, is we don't know exactly numbers-wise how many of these are going out and at what rate, which to me is the most concerning element of this. It's not totally dissimilar from any other console launch, but it is quite unsimilar in the fact that even when the PlayStation 3 or Nintendo Wii were flying off shelves, people had to, you know, it's like a Black Friday beatdown. we don't know exactly what Oculus's manufacturing arm looks like in terms of how quickly they're producing these things, because it really is, aside from a Facebook investment, it really is quite an internal endeavor. No one knows exactly how many are getting produced per week, nor how many exactly are getting shipped out. And as it currently stands, the estimated ship date for new Oculus orders on their website is listed as July. So that's 3 months and change away from now if you order one today.
Man. And I think that's problematic because the launch library of games is extraordinary. It really is. There are 30 games in total, and they range all the way from free to I believe Chronos, which is $49.99, kind of representing that full, you know, full complete game experience. And then you've got Lucky's Tale, Blake, and Blake will attest to the wonder of Lucky's Tale. You've got Lucky's Tale and Eve Valkyrie bundled for free, which are both outstanding games. And you've got the stinkers, you know, you've got games like I think it's called VR Tennis Online, which is just the worst example of virtual reality being kind of shoehorned into a game where it doesn't belong.
They also have Dread Halls, which for anyone who's been paying attention to VR trends in the last 2 years will remember as that like quintessential horror game that Markiplier or PewDiePie were playing with the DK1s or 2s. That's a launch title. And I mean, you know, credit to that team for, you know, being one of the trendsetters, but I am shocked that they're kind of just releasing that game as is, as a launch title. It really felt like one of those quintessential tech demos back in the DK2 days.
Yeah, but when you look at how many complete game experiences you have, you know, it's Chronos, Eve Valkyrie, Adrift, Lucky's Tale, it's coming out of the gate with several, I think, strong pieces of software that justify the hardware's existence. And that's always something that, you know, you want with a platform or console launch, right?
It is. I think that a lot of people have compared Lucky's Tale to Mario 64 and kind of like what that showed console gaming could be the 3D type of gaming. And I mean, I was looking the other day at the launch of the N64. It had two titles at the launch, and not to say that that's the way to do it or not the way to do it. But I'm glad that there are comprehensive games out that do show what this is. And, you know, again, we'll still talk a little bit more about the launch. You know, just looking back at the history of console launches, I think is a good test right now.
How do you feel it compares from a software perspective to some of the best console launches in history?
I mean, I think it's incredibly strong. I think that, and the reason that it is because of what you've been kind of highlighting, Jason, you know, on social media, whether it's your interview with Adam Orth or just other things you've been talking about, the developers, for the first time in several years, the developers are more excited than ever to create games. And so when that's happening, and even Evalkyrie, which was kind of a Skunkworks project that was not necessarily supposed to be happening, you know, when these things are happening, it shows that the creators are that interested in this, and that's why you're going to get such strong launch titles, not just for the Rift, but for the Vive next week and for everything. And so I think that, you know, it bodes really well. It does. And it kind of, it reminds me, I think there's a lot of comparison to be made to the NES launch in 85/86. And I think that you could look at, there's comparison between the kind of the quantities and the release schedule with Nintendo. I wouldn't say that Oculus and Nintendo have very much in common as a corporate entity, but it worked really well for Nintendo back then. And the reason that I make that comparison is not just that, you know, because of the Famicom, Nintendo had a great lineup of games available and games that were able to do different things than what your previous consoles have been able to do. But also, you know, one of the big things that Nintendo was trying to achieve with the launch of the 8-bit NES was to remove the stigma of the previous era of gaming, that people thought the fad was over. And you know, I think one fun thing for me, for researching this book has been that almost everybody I've spoken with at these companies, when they first heard about quote unquote VR coming back, they were like, oh, not this tune again. We know how that story ends. Come on, get real. Didn't you hear that it's dead? And I could imagine, you know, that's what Nintendo people were hearing back in 1985 when they were visiting with retailers. Didn't you hear that video games were dead?
Right.
So, I think that there's an interesting comparison between 1985 and now, and you could say positive things or negative things about how Nintendo rolled out the NES, but it did in the end do well.
Given my younger age, so obviously my perspective of launches has been more modern. Obviously PlayStation 4, PlayStation 3, all the way back to like Dreamcast and such. I really have no tolerance for any naysayers who might claim that we have 30 launch titles, and I think the number like has been more along the lines of 50 for this initial few months, right?
Right.
And yeah,
100 by the end of the year.
100 within within what essentially amounts to 8 months or so, accounting for holiday season stuff, November-ish. And 30 at launch is insane, even accounting for those obvious more tech demo or interactive narrative stuff like, I don't know, Gary the Gull or some of the more movie-based elements. That no console, in my memory at least, has launched with more than, I want to say, 10, 12 max kind of titles, and a lot of those stood as kind of half-inspired tech demos themselves. To give the most recent example is, of course, Knack for the PS4. It's kind of the anti-Lucky's Tale, if you will, of an approachable aesthetic that is meant to entice players to be like, well, we have a variety of stuff here. It's not just spaceflight sims or gritty graphics, it's something approachable, but Knack ended up essentially just being kind of a ho-hum, frustrating experience that was more or less just a tech demo for PlayStation's, what's the term I'm looking for? The particle physics engine that they had developed. Mm-hmm. And, right. I mean, what an engine, but come on, $50 for that. So that's
to be fair. I mean, there's a lot of those ho-hum experiences on the Rift as well. And we'll,
exactly.
we should probably dive into that later on, but. But yeah, I mean, like, quick answer here, and maybe a more detailed answer later on in the show. But Joseph, let me ask you, you don't have a retail Rift yet. Based on your consumer facing view, like you as a consumer, you looking at the press coverage of the Rift launch, would you buy one today?
If I were not me, like if I'm average Joe consumer as opposed to games journalist with too much on it, with too much hand time on his hands, Joe, I don't know. It's just like those days when the PS3 was coming out for $600, with not so much, to back it up. It's a big price gap, and it's a bigger price gap than even Palmer Luckey, Oculus founder, anticipated some months back before the Facebook acquisition. And, like all average consumers, I probably wait around holiday, and that way you're going to have, the big three, not including Gear VR likely, duking it out based on a library. And I think honestly, as much as I am already invested in Oculus and I'm upgrading my own PC for the matter, the PlayStation will, I anticipate, nuke the competition with its 35 million install base as of January 2015 or 2016, excuse me.
Blake, let me ask you real quick, same question that I asked Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I was the average person and not writing a book about this, I would say that no, I probably wouldn't go out and spend $599 on a Rift or need to upgrade my computer to play it. But if I were like a kid in school, I'd start becoming friends with the kid that was able to do that. You know, my interest has peaked enough. You know, the press has convinced me enough that there's something cool here. I think that the fact that you're both of our answers is no, we probably wouldn't, you know, it's not like we would just start selling our, body parts to, you know, get this thing is part of the reason why we have this concept of, you know, a launch not being a launch, you know, like Paul Tassi's article, you know, and what we're talking about, you know, I think that Oculus anticipated that this is, you know, there's a lot of comparisons made to the, you know, the launch of the smartphone in terms of what the potential of VR could be, but it's not the kind of thing where, this is going to replace something that we already have, or that this is something that everybody could use right away. So, you know, I think that they would, you know, the worst case scenario would have been to, overproduce and to strike out with that than to, you know, kind of gradually roll this out.
Yeah, I think ultimately that is a safer bet, right? Is, no company can sustain being in the red, for too long. So, they'll be able to take the PR hit that is, difficult to find units, low shipping numbers, and by the time the holiday season comes around, they'll be something like 6 months stronger than their opponents, despite the fact that PlayStation will inevitably have some innate advantage in the manufacturing arm because they've launched numerous consoles at this point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think HTC has that advantage as well. Although they, you know, they're disadvantaged by the price point, obviously. And that's where PSVR really stands to win and maybe even usher in a pretty decent, like, mass adoption of VR, not this year, but maybe over the next 2 or 3 years. But yeah, let's save all that for later. I feel like we could talk about just this for hours on end. But Joe, why don't you talk a little bit about our next news item?
Google is announcing an iOS dev kit for Cardboard. And that really just stuck out to me. It's not massive news, but it is worth paying attention to because Google Cardboard, you know, you attend any tech or interactive media event, and if you play your cards right, they hand these things out like candy. I've got one or two sitting on my shelf right now. And this just kind of fascinated me because this now means that Apple, or at least iOS developers, can take a chunk out of the VR market. So essentially, part of the announcement also included a new VR view platform. Think along the lines of if you're on a housing website, the virtual tour that the bigger ones usually have could essentially become a VR experience that gives you that more 360 view, as opposed to kind of fiddling with an HTML interactive element. But the biggest bit is that they're releasing a cardboard SDK that's a dev kit for Android and iOS just by adding a few lines of code. It's not a drastic change. It was essentially only available to Android mobile developers, and I believe that's essentially it. It was a very short press release that they put out. It was actually more focused on the new VR view technology that they were adding a functionality for. But the idea that Google Cardboard, of course, is allowing an iOS dev kit, Android being a Google property, I find quite interesting that it opens up for iOS.
What is Google's play here?
Domination, clearly.
Skynet. I mean, really though, like I don't quite understand what they have to gain by enabling iOS developer. I mean, from a pure monetary perspective, I really don't understand the play here.
Right. They're being fairly tight-lipped about it. No one quite knows exactly how much of like the Google VR related teams are dedicated to kind of making this happen soon. But
what's your guys' opinions of Google Cardboard in general?
I honestly have not tried it. And I know there's no excuse for that, but I honestly haven't tried it.
It is I have one, and I've been, forcing parents and friends to try it because obviously I don't have a $600 Oculus unit yet, but, it is, for all intents and purposes, a poor man's VR, but it does at least start the conversation, I feel, in a really positive way, because if you get a really good demo, like the introductory one that the Google Cardboard app plays for you as soon as you boot it up, it does that job of, as long as the phone is, angled correctly, as long as you don't have glasses on. It does a pretty decent job of giving you that sense of, whoa, this is cool, and I'm looking around and I'm in control of the experience. My own father, he's a 6-year-old truck driver, but he was relatively fascinated by one particular scene in that Cardboard demo, where you're just sitting on a boat and a whale, jumps out of the water and makes a big splash. And it's very low tech. It's very stylized, but seeing him, an old man who self-professed to not really giving a damn about any of this, felt really good. And I feel like it is a good conversation starter, and they hand them out like candy. So what does Google have to lose other than sinking its claws into a consumer base slowly?
And I guess that is their, that is their main directive lately. I just have always worried that an experience like Google Cardboard would actually, could actually stand to push people away, given the kind of the lo-fi nature of it.
That's been my experience with it personally. I mean, I'm actually really happy to hear that your father was intrigued enough by that. But, I'd say that my biggest skepticism when I heard about VR coming back was that it would just be really gimmicky. And I think that that's, to me, feels like what Google Cardboard is. It's very gimmicky, right? And gimmicky things can be cool. But to me, it doesn't, like, in my experiences of trying to convert people or force the stuff on them, I feel like it doesn't start a conversation. It kind of ends it, where it's like, all right, yeah, that's cool. Not for me. But I get it.
Part of that for me, though, is also the idea that, one, they hand it out like candy, and my dad attends enough events to know that he got one in his Wall Street Journal subscription. Evidently, Wall Street Journal sent out a number of them, or it might have been New York Times. But
The New York Times sent it out to, I think, 1.3 million at-home subscribers.
So, and also just the identity, it's a smart move in terms of branding and identity to call it, this is Cardboard. This is literally a school toy that your kid might bring home on a really good week. And you're like, huh, what's that all about? So yeah, I definitely see the point in terms of diminishing the conversation, by, misleading older or less acclimated, enthusiasts about what VR is capable of. But could we also say that maybe there might not have been a conversation without Cardboard there in the first place, other than obviously news hype?
Jason, are you going to simulate the reality where we find out whether we have that conversation or not without Google Cardboard?
I was simulating my microphone being muted, actually, but.
I mean, I think that it's, I don't think there's like a right answer to it. I think that, and I am sincerely glad to hear that you've had a different experience. But
it's a challenge, believe me, but
I do worry that it poisons the well a little bit in terms of, you know, when you ask, what do they have to gain? What do they have to lose? I just cynically think, what they have to gain is hurting other people.
Right. I mean, because for, you know, for VR evangelists like myself, I mean, that's kind of what I'm calling myself now because I'm so gung ho about it. But, you know, you really, you have to very carefully craft that first experience. You know, I have a friend coming over tonight and it's going to be her first time in any kind of VR headset. And I have thought deliberately about like exactly how I'm going to acclimate her to the experience. You know, I'm thinking about like having her just watch something passively like Henry or Gary DeGull to get her kind of familiar with the headset being on her face and familiar with the concept of actually being able to look right and left and behind her. And then maybe like the first level of Lucky's Tale or something that's not too intense. And I think it's really important to introduce people to VR the right way, or they're just going to, you know, dismiss it and never come back.
So I have a fairly interesting story that might be fairly applicable here. My dad, like I mentioned, is a trucker. He's worked in the trucking industry for, gosh, I want to say the last 25, maybe 30 years. And, for a time when I was little, he used to work for GE, and GE had a truck driver training program that used, a lot of, not virtual reality, but like massive simulation units. So they would put a driver up in like a fake truck cab with like a movie theater size screen and a really low res, simulation of a highway off ramp. And, that kind of thing like came back to the forefront of my mind because of the release of American Truck Simulator, which I don't believe on any platform is going for VR. I think it's just a standalone PC title. But I thought about those kinds of experiences of, so Google Cardboard could potentially neuter a lot of that conversation, a lot of that goodwill that, you know, mom or dad might not be willing to try out an Oculus at a booth at Best Buy. But if you get them to play an experience, maybe not a cockpit simulator, maybe not Lucky's Tale or Chronos, but something very approachable like American Truck Simulator, where it is still effectively a cockpit simulator because you're in a truck. But that has the power to really spark some great conversations. And that's just my personal example of trucks and my dad bringing me to these offices and kind of bonding over, this cool blend of my passion and his. But I think about like, you know, he's 60 and he's in great health, but he won't always be able to drive a truck. And it is one of those things that he really enjoys doing and really enjoys reading about and learning more about. At a certain point, might the Oculus, be that window he sees as a future method for fulfilling that kind of lifestyle desire?
I absolutely think it will. In fact, dun, 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 dun. This brings us to our next news topic. So the biggest problem right now in my mind with virtual reality is VR sickness, or what some people call simulator sickness. And that is basically, it's kind of a version of motion sickness while you're in VR. And, the big problem, let me explain kind of why this happens, right? It is, there's some very technical ways to describe it and some very non-technical ways. So we've got this really complicated sensory system in our inner ear called the vestibular system. And it kind of informs our brain about like where we are in 3D space and how we're moving around 3D space. And what happens when we get motion sick in VR is, we're seeing movement in the game. And because VR delivers that sense of presence that we talked about earlier, your brain believes you're in there, but then your inner ear is saying, hey, no, you're not, because I don't feel that movement. And so then you get, you know, you get nauseous. You get a little bit, very uncomfortable if you don't get out of there. Well, apparently for the last 10 years, and this just came out in the news today, for the last decade, the Mayo Clinic has been working on a technology to solve that, that basically it syncs your inner ear to what you're viewing on screen. And so it uses these four different connection points. I haven't seen them up close or anything, but let me go to my article on this just so that I can actually say this a little bit more coherently. So there's basically four simulation points, and I think it's one behind your ear, two on the back of the neck, and one on your forehead. And what they've done is they've licensed this technology that they call galvanic vestibular stimulation, but we're just going to use GVS for short. And it does that synchronization. And so this LA-based entertainment startup called V-Motion have secured the exclusive global rights to use Mayo Clinic's technology in commercial products. And so this is where, like, this kind of thing could possibly affect you in the future. The platform that they've developed behind this, it can be integrated into like existing operating systems like Windows, or Android or iOS. It can be used in VR goggles or AR glasses. It can be used in TVs. And the real hook is that game developers don't really have to like add any additional code to their games. As long as the platform they're developing the experience for supports the technology, then it does all that syncing automatically. So like if you're watching Avatar and you're kind of the characters are flying over Pandora, right? You're actually feeling those sensations. If you're playing Call of Duty and your character's running towards cover or like jumping off a roof, maybe you don't want to feel that, but you will feel what that your inner ear will translate what it's, you know, what's happening on screen to that actual like sense of balance in your brain. Does that make sense?
I just clarify one thing because I'm curious is reading the article and looking at kind of the associated images here. Is it simulating that sense of movement while the head is still like completely immobile? It's not moving, or is it kind of encouraged for you to like, obviously instinctually you'll move your head a little bit to account for flying through the sky or falling off a cliff, but I wonder if it still works just as well if you're kind of like lying back in your seat trying to not move as much.
From what I've seen of the video interviews and the materials that they sent me, it will work if your head is completely motionless.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what will happen. Like, let's say you're using an HTC Vive and you're using this GVS technology from Mayo Clinic and G-Motion, and you're playing something like Vanishing Realms or Everest, and you're physically walking around in that space in your room. I don't know if there will be like a conflict between what the technology is conveying to your inner ear and what you're already perceiving. I think there's probably a lot of work to do there.
It reminds me a lot of these.
It's pretty wild, yeah.
It reminds me a lot of these Disney World rides that were, you know, you're flying through space, or what was the
Mission Space one? I got so sick on Mission Space because it's just basically horrible VR. It's horrible.
But you know, this is curious to me because I actually just talked to a person for a Polygon story I'm writing. And she's a 79-year-old YouTube Let's Player star. And I was talking to her about, you know, accessibility issues and just where do you feel that the games industry is lacking in terms of making these games accessible for you. And she was talking a lot about how in Skyrim or Witcher, the combat is way too fast-paced, so she gets disoriented really easily. And apropos of really nothing on my end, she mentioned inner ear equilibrium, this sense of that fluid in your ear that helps every human keep their balance. And this is why this fascinated me, is because it's something that she's not aware of, obviously, but but they're already working on it. And now she might, she said that she was interested in VR, but her sons, were discouraging her because they didn't want her to, you know, fall or
to be sick.
Get sick.
Well, sure. Yeah.
But now, well, and, look, they have the option.
And what's interesting is this sprung from, aerospace research, like I forget what their lab is called, but they have an aerospace lab and they consulted the Defense Department for years and years. And the whole idea behind this was to mitigate simulator sickness among pilots. But then they realized when I don't know when exactly, but at some point, you know, when it seemed like VR was probably going to be here to stay for a while via, you know, the Oculus Rift, at some point they realized like this could be really applicable to VR. And so now they're saying that not only will this help, you know, pilots in training and people experiencing VR, but it also has a lot of medical applications, like helping people who have balance problems, helping people with vertigo. They actually specifically call out the elderly and using this to kind of recalibrate your balance and help avoid falls and things like that. It's pretty wild.
That's essentially the essence of part of the article I'm writing is I asked a professor, you know, well, will the challenges of accessibility in games change as the generations that have grown up their entire lives with, you know, very sleek game systems and game experiences, will the challenges change as they enter older adulthood and we won't have to worry so much about motion sickness or this or that? And he said, no, this is pretty across the board. Effects of aging is a diminishing of inner ear equilibrium, and I'm sure that certain challenges will arise and diminish as time goes on and as technology becomes more we grow accustomed to it in life. But something like this that could be ever present in elder citizens is really important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really can't wait to see how this technology progresses. I mean, I'm sure it's in its, you know, very much in its infancy right now. And I don't think that we'll see it integrated into something, you know, a popular consumer product like PlayStation VR or Oculus Rift in the very near future. But I have to imagine those conversations are happening right now. I have to imagine that, like, you know, movie theater owners and the entertainment industry are thinking about how can we present an experience with Avatar 2 where people actually feel like they're flying, you know, like in an IMAX theater or with like a Gear VR. I don't know. Who knows? Like, that's what's crazy about VR is it's even though it's been around for a while, it was so modern VR is just such a different story. And we can't even imagine the things that people are going to come up with to support that technology.
Since this isn't a question I think we have highlighted on our listener portion, Blake, I am curious if in your experience talking to VR developers for this book, if you ever delved really far into the health concerns. We've thought about doing an episode kind of dedicated to the broad sense of health issues arising in VR, but I'm wondering if that was something that developers mentioned to you, maybe apropos of any actual interview question.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that aside from the poor quality of the VR in the 90s, the number two reason or the part of the stigma, the negative stigma is like, oh, it makes you sick or you can't spend extended amounts of time there. And so especially in Oculus early on, you know, making sure that they solved that issue was a big deal. So I admittedly haven't read your article yet, Jason, but I'm happily shocked or shocked that that somebody else feels like they were able to, because it's been very much on everyone's minds, and I think that, you know, solving it or getting at least to the point where it's a relatively non-factor is so critical to extending the lifespan and really helping this thing take off.
Yeah, I completely agree. And isn't it crazy that, like, as we're recording this, the Oculus Rift has officially been a launched consumer product for 2 days, and someone is already solving some of the major problems surrounding the platform. I think that's incredible.
All of it has happened so fast. If you think that, Oculus, the Kickstarter was in August 2012, less than 4 years ago, and there's several hardware providers that are about to market, and more so just all the content is even just on, you know, the Gear VR, which I do own. And that's usually what I use to try to lure people into falling in love with VR.
That's a good gateway.
I'm shocked by how much content is on there and how much pretty good content. You know, it's not just like gimmicky garbage. And once again, it like really speaks to just what you crystallized in that interview with Adam about that everyone is so excited about this and that excitement and you know, of getting our best minds or our most creative minds, getting everyone onto one problem or onto one area. You're going to get quicker solutions. I think it's probably a coincidence that 2 days after the Rift launch, this happens. But it's not a coincidence because it's the attention on VR that right. the Rift provided, as well as the other soon to come hardware devices.
I mean, I think that whoever, you know, were the marketing brains behind Mayo Clinic and this partnership obviously thought, hey, let's ride the hype train a little bit and announce this. You know, they've been working on it for a decade. And so it's obviously no coincidence that they announce it now, but I love the fact that, all corners of the industry are coming together to really ensure that this thing takes off.
I will say that, when I interned at Game Informer, which was September to December of 2015, that was when they, did their Year of VR issue, which is a very good issue if no one's read it yet. It delved into all the major systems, and Andy Mack, the editor-in-chief, since time immemorial of that magazine, said that in all his time covering the industry, he didn't think he'd ever seen teams of developers as excited about the possibilities. He had never seen them as excited in 20 plus years of doing this.
I believe
it. And he would never say that. Like, he's on the record now as saying that. And I can't believe the weight and gravity that those words carry.
Like, game developers, you know, film directors, these people are artists. We don't always talk about them in such a way, but they're artists and they really like to push the envelope and they like to continuously create new things. And this is just kind of that perfect, palette for them to do that. Ah, so excited. I love VR. That's why we're doing this show. That's just, it's so exciting, and I hope that that excitement is infectious, and I hope that people in the very near future have a chance to just walk into a Best Buy or a GameStop and try a Rift or try a Gear VR, you know?
Yeah, that's actually the fact that there's no place to try it right now is, I wouldn't say frustrating, because But in terms of like the launch, I don't have any problem with the fact that you can't even pre-order one. If you pre-order one, you won't get it until July or something like that. But it's that, you know, I'm doing interviews for movie articles and stuff, and I'm telling everyone about VR because I can't shut up about it. And they're like, oh, that sounds really cool. What do I do? Like, how do I try this? And I'm like, oh yeah, well, I'll contact you once you can go into your local Best Buy and try it. Cause like, at least the thing with the NES was that you could go into a store and play it, even if you couldn't buy it, you know, it like, because as we've discussed, you know, it's something you really have to experience for yourself. It's not like a commercial is necessarily going to help you make that leap. So,
not at all,
having places where we can, at least direct people to, get teased with the power of this thing.
It'll be interesting to see exactly what level, that in-store element takes from various companies. I think PlayStation will be the smartest about it because they've obviously had years of experience of just, you know, even in a Walmart, something as simple as that, having PlayStation kiosks in the gaming section, which at least in my area, they still have plenty of those in every gaming section where you can play the latest PS4 demos. But obviously there's a wall to climb there in terms of, well, this thing that you put on your face is 3 times as expensive, and also you put it on your face. So someone walking into a Best Buy or, God forbid, a Walmart, it's going to require a bit of expertise like an attendant standing there at the booth, you know, wiping it down. Just like every GDC demo, there's someone there with a box of sanitary wipes. And if you think it got bad at GDC or at any tech show, man, just wait until Cletus at Walmart tries it before you.
You know, God, I never even thought about that. Like, that's a very real issue.
Exactly. And well, you want to talk about, like, just hesitancy to try it. My dad, you know, doesn't have any second guesses about putting on the cardboard after I might have it on my face. But you want to clamp the PSVR onto mom after Jesse from accounting did? Good luck with that.
Well, Jesse from accounting, he has a bad reputation, but I think it's a little overblown. No, but, you know, looking at this kind of in the way of launching the concept of video games back with, like, the, you know, Magnavox Odyssey and Atari, you know, it was really the out-of-home experience, the arcade experience that made people want to bring it into the home. And so part of this, you know, proselytizing process, too, might be the out-of-home experience, you know, whether it's VRcade or whether it's, you know, Starbreeze, before they launch their Star VR headset, is going to be doing stuff, you know, have an arcade and basically just having these opportunities for people to play. You know, I think that could be really pivotal as well. And I've spoken with those people, and the health concern or the sanitary aspect is a really big deal because of everything you're describing. So at least they're aware of it, but, you know, VR is a very personal experience with that headset on, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, why don't we get into the meat here? Let's get into our field of view with the Oculus Rift launch.
And just to clarify, that field of view is essentially our week-to-week major topic, right, Jason?
Yeah, kind of where we just drill down into one. You know, it could be kind of piggybacking off of a news item, going into a deeper conversation about that, or, you know, just something that is important to the VR industry, whether it's a product or a concept or a, you know, anything. Like you mentioned earlier, we'd love to have an entire episode just devoted to the health concerns of VR, maybe dispelling some of the myths and maybe tackling how to have better VR experiences and not trigger motion sickness and things like that. Just one of many, many ideas that we've got.
So yeah, so major topic of this week, of course, episode one. What a great time to start the podcast itself because the Oculus Rift has just launched. And as we talked a little bit about in detail earlier, that comes with a lot of questions, concerns, and a lot of excitement too. The launch lineup includes about 30 games. You know, some, of course, those more experienced type encounters, some full games like Chronos sitting at $50. We're going to be talking about the overall launch library and the interface, which comes with its own concerns. Some people, I believe, are not able to access it quite as well as they wish they could. But also we'll be talking about the best use of VR on the Rift and the worst use of VR. And we'll be discussing the right time to jump in, because that seems to be the biggest question. Is it right to do this now and make those upgrades, or is it maybe worth waiting until the holiday season? And I will just say this as a brief shout out. We mentioned it earlier, but I got a lot of my perspective on this from, your fellow Forbes writer, Paul Tassi, wrote an article, about the Oculus launch called "When is a launch a launch?" Or is a launch a launch except when it's the Oculus Rift?
One of our most popular articles on the site right now.
Hey, Forbes is known for some cutthroat articles.
Well, it's one. I mean, I've mentioned earlier that I kind of disagree. I don't think it was a bad decision, but I think it's definitely something that should be talked about. And I really like Paul's article.
Yeah, and like he says, basically, here's the biggest problem with the launch. You can't read a review of the Oculus Rift, admit to yourself that you really want one, and then just on impulse go to the store and buy it. And
to be fair, though, that the same exact thing happened with a lot of console launches, except maybe this last year of PS4 and Xbox One. I don't know anyone who struggled to get one, but that was because PlayStation learned very hard lesson the last round, too.
Yes. And well, I mean, I remember trying to get a Nintendo Wii, even, I think, you know, 4 to 6 months after it launched, and it was still very hard to find, but it was, you could go get it. Like I could go, you know, a couple cities north and maybe pick one up. I could pre-order one and have it delivered in a few weeks. I mean, there were ways to acquire it, and like, there's literally no retail store to go buy it at, and no way to obtain one if you're buying it brand new from the Oculus site until July.
And I believe the biggest issue, especially on Paul's end, was he struggled, one, to make the account that his order was placed under, but also that account more or less didn't allow him to kind of check the any sort of status update on how his order was doing, because he was one of the earlier adopters. But there's no such thing as, hey, we're estimating about 2 weeks until we're able to ship out your Oculus, or we're estimating 2 months. Yeah. Or
so it, so the communication is a problem,
right?
Or the lack of communication.
And that's not to say that it needs to be a UPS style, you know, put in your number here and we're going to tell you exactly what building it's in at what hour, but having a better idea than soon shrug, is necessary.
Well, and he says that Oculus support itself needs a little bit of work. He couldn't find a direct line to call. No one had responded to his ticket. He Googled how to create an Oculus ID because he couldn't find a place to do that on the main Oculus.com site. And the most relevant link he could find was a third-party site that did a step-by-step guide explaining how to create an Oculus ID. So, yeah. And he ordered it. I think he ordered his, pre-ordered his about 90 minutes after it went live. I pre-ordered mine 2 or 3 hours after it went live, and my order status page just says TBA still. And to be clear, I'm using an engineering sample of the consumer version from, a publisher that's on loan from a publisher. That was to help facilitate a review. So that's where my experience is coming from. I don't actually have my consumer Rift just yet, but I have been able to evaluate the consumer experience. But yeah, it's an issue. And a lot of people are kind of like, oh, well, Facebook has billions. They should be able to solve this. And I think that's kind of unfair. Because it seems to me that Facebook has actually given Oculus a lot of breathing room to operate under their own guidance and, you know, their own direction. And,
well, and not only that, Facebook, certainly they have the resources, but, you know, they have never been in the hardware business before.
They actually have. It hasn't been very successful, but they did have a short-lived Facebook phone.
All right.
But I mean, I think that was done with a hardware partner like HTC or somebody like that. And right. So I'm sure HTC handled the production and the manufacturing of that. So, yeah, it's a good point. It's a very good point.
Yeah, I certainly understand Paul's frustration, and I think it's the communication aspect around it that's really the unfortunate thing. I can imagine that, you know, one thing that I've really admired about Oculus is that they have always waited until they had something firm to say before announcing it. You know, I know that that's something that's very important to them, is to not promise something or show something that is not going to be available. You know, whereas like the 5 was supposed to come out last year. So, I suspect that that's part of it, but it would be great if Paul wasn't having to go to third parties to figure out how to set up his ID and did have some clarity, especially as someone who obviously was very interested in purchasing it right at when pre-orders became available.
I think the most fascinating thing for me is just Facebook has some experience in manufacturing hardware, but unlike console launches prior, and this is no fault of Oculus itself, I have no idea what Oculus's manufacturing arm looks like. And that doesn't like fill me with dread or anything, but I am just curious, you know, where are they making them? Who's making them? At what rate? And I believe one of my favorite YouTube series, bonus credits, or extra credits, excuse me, had an episode about like, well, how are consoles made? Where are they made? Who makes them? In what fashion? And delved into that kind of factory manufacturing chain to give you a better idea of, well, where does this huge hunk of hardware come from? And I'm sure it's not drastically different, but I just wonder at what scale. But I don't know.
And I guess all we can do is speculate. And I don't know if that does our listeners any good, but right. You know, we have to at least assume that they have been doing their best to ramp up the production line to the best of their ability. We don't know what hurdles are there. We don't know if it's just, you know, the limited supply of components. There's no, where's it being manufactured? Who's creating all the, it's crazy that we have such a, you know, ethereal have almost no
understanding
into the manufacturing process. Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully they'll be more transparent with that as time goes on.
But yeah, why don't we jump into a little bit more solid ground here? And this could even serve, we can get a lot from you on this, Blake. Discussion about the overall launch library, how these 30 plus games are kind of shaping up in the first month of the launch. Obviously, not everybody and their mother is playing them because not everybody has their Oculus even yet. But why don't you tell us a bit about Lucky's Tale, since that's obviously one that a vast majority of Oculus users will be experiencing on some level.
Well, hopefully 100% of them, since it, yeah. It's one of the two games that's bundled with the Rift. For a person like myself who grew up with friends like Mario and Sonic, to me it is a wonderful gateway into virtual reality gaming. And I really, you know, I wrote a piece for Upload the other day about the creation, the making of Lucky's Tale. And, you know, so much of what I liked about it was that it was, you know, it was made by Playful, which is a company founded by Paul Bettner. And he was the guy, him and his brother created Words with Friends. And they did that for the iPhone when the iPhone just came out. And this was sort of, they called it pop software, which was like games for not necessarily gamers, but just for everyone. A different type of gaming. And I really like that Lucky provides a familiar game experience, but also it's different in so many ways. And I think that he's in a very different way. They've done a good job of kind of creating a follow-up to that Words with Friends concept.
I had no idea that it was from those same developers until I read your article at Upload VR, which was fantastic, by the way. Such a weird research can pull up, huh?
Such a weird leap.
Yeah, it is. It's. Do you feel?
It seems very odd until I understood what went into both things, and then it made a lot of sense to me that, you know, it's somebody who enjoys being on the cutting edge and taking advantage of new features and new platforms and popularizing them, and you can kind of see. You know, the narrative is very different, or the gameplay is very different, but probably the adjectives you would use to describe what's nice about both games is similar. They feel familiar, they feel innovative, they feel there's a different type of connection.
Yeah, super easy to pick up and play.
Yeah, exactly.
And not really something you can... It's really interesting, because if you just look at gameplay for Lucky's Tale, it's like, oh, it's just a 2D platformer. Okay. It's so hard. That's so challenging. So challenging for writers and podcasters to actually, you know, relay the experience of so many of these games, what it actually feels like to play them.
Well, you're so right. And that's why I love the idea that it's from the guy who brought you Word with Friends, because there's millions of people who can understand that. This looks very different, but it's like a lot of, you know, with the movies from the director of, it's a different genre.
Yeah.
It's a different actor. But you kind of know that the last time you paid $15 to see this movie, you had a good experience. This guy is someone you trust. He knows what he's doing, and there's a good chance that you're going to have a unique but equally as enjoyable experience again. And that's what I loved about finding that out was that, you know, anything just from like a writing perspective of how do you get somebody to try it? Because that's really all it can do. It's unlike consoles of the past or movies. Seeing the commercial isn't going to be enough to convince you, because it's something that you can't.
Right.
Watch and think, okay, yeah, I get it. You have to experience it. So anything that's going to drive people towards that, I love. And, you know, so having someone like Paul Bettner is a great asset to virtual reality.
And how do you convince them to play Lucky's Tale? All they have to do is get a $600 headset and probably about $1,000 PC.
It's, I like the idea that, going off what you said, Blake, just the idea that you get a similar sense of feeling from director to director. So like classic Spielberg movies all feel the same. They have that similar spirit to me. And reading your article before we started recording was, yeah, definitely giving me that sense of they're using their experience in terms of bringing friends together through a very casual game experience, but turning it on its head in this new trend-setting technology. So, like, even in a Spielberg movie, as technology develops, you know, and as computer graphics get better, you still get that similar vibe.
Right. Speaking of Spielberg, like, we're totally going to reassemble when Ready Player One comes out and talk about that, right?
Yeah.
We're getting two very different reactions just now.
Why the
somebody groaned? Who groaned?
That was me.
Not Blake Harris. I am very excited for the movie, and I wouldn't be writing this book if not for Ready Player One, I don't think. But why the groan?
I haven't read it yet. I will confess to that. But listen to me. I worked as a librarian for 4 years. I've seen a lot of book trends come and go, and just I've heard impressions of it. And also, what's his next book, Armada? That was just kind of got like
not
skewered, just skewered in the media for being like a smorgasbord of 80s references that made no sense.
Okay, I don't want to go off on a tangent for too long here, but Ready Player One is one of my favorite books of all time, and Armada is one of the worst. So don't treat them as connected.
Right.
Agreed. So, and like, listen, I enjoyed a lot of the 80s pop cultural references in Ready Player One, but I think that's just like the icing. That's
right.
You know, what's so cool about the book is how accessible it is, how accessible it makes the idea of a virtual reality, a future where virtual reality plays a huge part of our daily lives. And also, I love the idea that unlike so many futuristic books, it's not utopian or dystopian. It's kind of like, here's a potentially logical way that things could progress. Some things are great. Some things aren't. The world is probably in a little bit of a dystopian state, but it doesn't feel like the author is pushing a certain point of view that we need to embrace this technology or we need to avoid this technology. It's really just about showing you something that could be and providing a fun story. It's an adventure story, really.
So to get back to the topic, I think, what are some of the other games that have seemed to define this launch, and maybe in a good way or a bad way? Because we also have best use of VR in the Rift and worst use of VR in the Rift as a discussion topic. I watched the Giant Bomb team do a live stream at like 11 hours of like all 30 games, and some of them
God, those
were...
Guys are- They are dedicated. I love those guys.
They were very sweaty afterwards. yeah. You want to talk about VR face. But I think for me, I really enjoyed seeing Air Mech being played. That's the kind of tabletop tower defense. You play against another player or the PC itself. And that felt really impressive as a fan of tabletop gaming like Warhammer, and
it's done so well. I reviewed that one for Upload VR. It's done extraordinarily well. It's subtle use of VR to really drive home that sense of presence, and it's just, it kind of also scratches your like Transformers itch a little bit, because you've got this you know, transforming mech that can like get down on the ground and you know, take it to the infantry, or he can actually fly around and move troops and, you know, get involved in aerial battles. And it's just, yeah, it's like this weird blend of like StarCraft Lite meets a MOBA meets a tabletop game. Just super, super cool launch title.
And I think there's obviously a number of those experience kind of games, like the, I forget what the title is, but it's basically where a giant T-Rex kind of walks up to your face and spooks you a little bit. But
oh, it's the I think Oculus Dreamscape,
something like that. And
something like that. Dream Deck, excuse me.
But I think, Jason, you've been reviewing the most VR games thus far that I've seen. And I think
trying to, yeah.
what are some of the more negative ones of this launch, at least?
Okay, avoid VR tennis online. Avoid it like the plague. It's one of those that is kind of like, hey, we really liked Mario Tennis and Virtua Tennis. And so here's a tennis game where we're just kind of shoehorning in this forced VR perspective, and it just doesn't add anything to the game at all. It doesn't feel like it was built for the ground up for VR, and that is what Oculus should be trying to highlight in their launch library, are games that really feel like you can't experience those outside of a Rift. I haven't played, honestly, I have not played very many subpar games. Dead Secret is really good, but it gave me a little bit of that motion sickness. There's stuff like, The Vanishing of Ethan Carter is great, but again, you have to kind of turn on this, something they did called comfort mode, which sort of just like teleports you to certain preset locations instead of actually having your character physically walk. Because the second that happens and you're not physically walking, you get that VR sickness. I can't really steer you away from too many other ones. And one that I will steer you away from, and I think a lot of people might disagree with me here, is Project Cars. I love Project Cars on the PC. I played the heck out of it. I played it with a wheel. And it's one of the best racing sims on the market. But the translation to VR feels a little bit forced, and you really notice a severe downgrade in the visual fidelity. And it's hard to describe why it doesn't work for me. But it doesn't feel like I'm actually in that cockpit. It just feels like kind of like I'm this weird camera in that cockpit instead of actually
the screen door effect.
It's not a screen door effect. It's just that, like, I don't know. Maybe the sense of depth that they're trying to convey is wrong. There's just something in my brain that says this isn't. I don't have presence in this game. I'm not in this car.
It's not as good as this podcast.
Whereas something like Eve Valkyrie, I feel very present in that cockpit, and I feel instantly immersed into that world, and it's believable and it looks good. But there's something just off about Project Cars. And again, I think it's because it wasn't built from the ground up for VR. And I think that's where a lot of developers are going to struggle. And I think a lot of the platform holders are going to struggle. We need something sort of like the old, Nintendo seal of approval, I think. You know, I mean, you don't want to block out. You don't want to just flat out say your game is subpar, you can't develop on our platform. But at the same time, you have to actively, and I know Oculus is doing this. I just don't know what degree, but you have to actively foster and cultivate those really made for VR experiences. And there are definitely some misses in this launch, but I think there's misses in every launch.
Blake, what about you? You've said that you haven't played too many games, right? But has anything stuck out to you in this particular month of games?
No, I really haven't played too many games other than Eve Valkyrie and Lucky's Tale.
Well, I think that might be the interesting thing about this launch itself is, as weak as launches historically are, with 30 games, and even some of them just being experiences, it does seem like there is at least something for everyone that isn't a total garbage show.
Totally, totally.
If you want cutesy third person, you've got Lucky's Tale. If you want intense first person cockpit action, it's the Valkyrie all the way. And
RPG, action RPG, you've got Chronos. Kind of your RTS, you've got Airmet Command.
It's a smart lineup as far as covering genres and making sure everyone has something to sustain themselves on for a few months. Now,
there's also I'd be remiss not to call out Adrift.
Yes,
and I do have a review of it up at Forbes, so definitely check that out if you're curious about the details. But I just did want to call out that it's an interesting title because it was built for the ground, you know, from the ground up for VR. But it's also been developed simultaneously as just a standard, like, PC, you know, on your monitor experience. But man, if you ever want to feel like, you know, if you ever want to experience what it probably feels like to be trapped in a destroyed space station in the middle of cold, dark space with complete freedom of movement in zero gravity, it's probably going to deliver that sensation. It's rated intense because the Oculus Store has comfort ratings on each of the games. And so far I would agree that they're pretty accurate. You know, like Lucky's Tale and Aramech are described as comfortable. And I definitely have played them for hours. I played Lucky's Tale for like 3 hours in a row last night. I felt fine. Adrift, the second you do a barrel roll in VR in space, woo, get a little sweaty, get a little panicky, like okay, like I gotta get out of here for a minute.
You want to talk about like amusing attempts to describe the power of VR to people who haven't played it. That was essentially my father and I this morning, because I knew it was going to be a topic we discussed. I'm on one side of the kitchen, he's on the other, and I'm like, okay, you see, there's an air canister hanging there in the middle of the kitchen, and I like do this stupid play on the movement, because I've played Adrift too, and that grasping for the air canister but not being able to quite get there because you either lack the oxygen or you just angled that jump wrong, and he just looked at me like, what the hell are you doing?
It's something I pointed out in my review, was that we've taken so many staples of game mechanics like for granted, like opening a door or like, you know, getting a health potion. and those have so much weight and so much presence and importance in VR. Like when I was playing Vanishing Realms, you know, and I had to actually walk over, like physically walk over to like this chest and open it and take out a health potion and put it in my backpack and save it for later. You know, it's crazy.
It's like learning how to walk all over again.
It sort of is. Yeah. And
someday you'll be jaded by it and think, oh man, I got to go walk across the room and open this chest. But
it's actually kind of, I think, brings us to the elephant in the room with the Oculus launch is it a actual complete launch? You know, casting aside the availability issues, is it a complete launch? And what I mean by that is Oculus has touch controllers that allow you to, you know, replace your Xbox One controller with, you know, actual motion sensitive controllers in each hand, similar to what the HTC Vive has with their touch controllers. And that changes the game. I was playing VR Sports on the Rift at GDC. And like, I don't know if you guys have ever, you know, most people have probably shot a basketball a few times in their life. And it was so hyper accurate that when I actually went through the motion, like I felt the second the ball left my hand, the quote unquote ball left my hand, I could tell if I was going to hit that shot or not based on like, oh, that my follow up felt kind of weird, or, oh, you know, like when a basketball player in real life kind of lets it go, like they know if they're going to make it or not based on how it felt. Right. And that is conveyed perfectly with the touch controllers. Being able to like Bullet Train, Epic's Bullet Train demo, being able to take your fingers and like, and pluck a bullet out of the air, physically pluck it out of the air and throw it back. Like those are experiences that completely change how you interact with virtual reality. And so as much as I'm having a blast, I can't recommend it. Like I can't say there's really a killer app yet. And there's really a justified reason to spend $599, because later on down the road, you're going to have to spend a little more to get that full complete experience. And there's going to be a lot of games that are being developed that are wonderful with those touch controllers that you just can't play right now. So, how do you guys feel about all that?
Well, Jason, did you try Toy Box also?
No, I didn't get a chance to try Toy Box. Have you?
Yeah, I thought it was incredible. That was, you know, I'm so interested in the social aspect of all this, and that really clinched it for me. So I too am excited for that and the touch controllers. Yeah, I mean, I can see it feels kind of like an incomplete launch, but I think that the whole process has been very iterative. You know, whether it's, I know that DK1 was just a dev kit, but it didn't feel that way. And the fact that the general mainstream public has been aware of Oculus for a year or two, and they haven't even launched a consumer product yet. I don't know. I think that, it definitely feels like a soft launch, and it's just kind of like phase not even phase one, like phase three of an ongoing plan.
That's interesting you bring that up, because I mean I've noticed that an entire community sprung up around DK1 and DK2 where like people were actively developing games just for each other, not for consumers, just for each other, like for the 150,000-200,000 DK2 users that were out there.
But I think the Let's Play community also had a hand in that, because that's what you saw a lot of people like PewDiePie or Markiplier playing on Dev Kit 1s and 2s, like Dreadhall. Right. And who would have thought Dreadhall would be anything more than a bullet point on a list somewhere if not for the world's most famous YouTube stars screaming their heads off with a brick on their face.
What do you think, Joe? I mean we kind of touched on this this question earlier, but I hadn't really brought the touch controllers into the conversation yet. So, I mean, do you think that's something that people should wait for, or should they invest now?
I like the touch controllers, and I think just like you said with the basketball examples, it's not quite haptic feedback, but it's that one more point of immersion. I'll give an example of why touch controllers seem to be a very important peripheral, and it also just raises concerns on my end of like, well, why isn't it immediately packed with the Oculus? It's a optional thing. I played Werewolves Within, which is being developed by Ubisoft Red Storm, one of the teams weirdly enough behind The Division and a bunch of other Tom Clancy titles. And have either of you played Avalon or Mafia or any of those Subterfuge games?
I honestly have not.
No. So what the concept of that is, it's just a table of friends, and one of you is the bad guy, the rest of you are good guys. And you might have abilities or something, but the core of the game is interrogate each other to learn who is the liar, who is the bad guy. And then at the end you all vote, and if you get the right guy, the good guys win. If the bad guy survives, he wins. And that. So this is Werewolves Within, is, as you might surmise, it's that with werewolves in VR. And it's really quite interesting. So the thing that ties it back to the touch controllers, the PR rep, when I was doing the demo at the Ubisoft office, the PR rep, very nice lady, but she was getting pissed off at me because I would like put the controller down, and I'm sitting across the table from someone who's in France. One of the developers, and I'm like pointing at him in VR, but with my real hand. So clearly he's not seeing anything. And this game is predicated on a lot of like, if I'm looking at someone across the table, they know exactly where I'm looking. They can kind of feel my eyes burning into them. And they do a really great job of simulating, like, if you stare at someone, they can kind of be like, Joe, why are you staring at me? And the character might react accordingly if you kind of shift back in your seat. So just the idea of touch controllers being there for when I need to, shout Jacques, is something I really hope that is implemented more, because you're going to get a lot of that, especially from those who aren't acclimated to the technology of they're not paying attention to the controller and maybe the four D-pad prompts for gesture animations. It's all about, I feel so much like I'm here that I'm pointing in real life and smashing my hand against the monitor.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if either of you played the lab from the Valve developed for the Vive, but like none of those demos needed any explanation because they drop you into a tower defense level, and you look out kind of over this edge and you see a bunch of, little shadowy figures like, walking towards your gate, and you see a bow in front of you, and you just pick up the bow and you kind of, you pick it up with your left hand and you pull back with your right hand. And it's instantly intuitive. It's instantly intuitive to swing a sword at, some 7-foot skeleton and without having to learn controls. And I think that's a real advantage for those touch controllers. Is that one-to-one replication of movement in the game world? One more thing I'll say is that I'm going to enthusiastically recommend a Rift purchase once those touch controllers come out.
And I think that answers our ultimate question: is now the right time to jump in? Well, you can, but you're going to be waiting a while. So it's not so much jumping yes. in as it is the right. slowest, the slowest toe dip into the nicest hot tub, you know, just agonizingly slow. But yeah, I would say, you know, if you're an enthusiast, you've probably already made your decision. Even though I'm gunning for it as soon as I can, I'm emailing Oculus reps saying, you know, hey, can I get myself pushed up a little bit in the climbing order? And, but if you're not as enthusiastic or if you still have questions, it's totally advised to wait until either those touch controllers come out and you get a better sense of that, or you just get a better sense of what everything will look like around holiday time.
Agreed. And if you guys have more questions about the Oculus Rift or VR in general, like I said, for now, I'll set up an email for us. But for now, hit me up on Twitter at KillYourFM, KillYourFM. And you can hit Joseph with questions as well at Joseph Noop, KNOOP. And we'll have links to the Twitter, our Twitter accounts on wherever the show notes land for this this show, which we don't even know yet, which is crazy, but I'm figuring that out later today. Right, let's wrap up episode one of Presence with some listener questions. You guys reached out to us with a ton of really thought-provoking questions, and we're going to answer a few of them this week, and we'll carry over the rest to future episodes. Let's kick it off. Here is a question for Blake. What is the biggest thing? This is from Joe H, by the way, Joe H on Twitter. Thank you. What is the biggest thing holding VR back at this time?
I think, you know, a killer app. I think that it would be great if there was that one thing that would make anybody from hardcore gamer to my mom feel like she needed to use it right now. But I'm confident that such a thing will come.
What do you think, Joe?
Similar regard, but maybe coming at it from a different angle. Facebook is certainly an option there, and obviously Facebook, a $2 billion acquisition. I would be stunned if that wasn't something that they planned on implementing soon. But along the lines of, yeah, there needs to be a killer app and a killer reason for, why this matters, not just to, the enthusiasts or the youthful crowd, but to mom and dad. So it isn't PlayStation necessarily dominating the Christmas season, because PlayStation is a recognized brand, right? And a killer app is the simplest way of putting it, I think. You, like we talked before, there is an argument to be made for whatever you want on Oculus. There's probably something there for you, whether it's strategy, cockpit simulator, Lucky's Tale, cutesy adventure, third-person stuff, RPG, Chronos. But I'd really be interested to see how they change that marketing going forward with non-gaming applications, because effectively, aside from the like in-home studio thing, you know, like looking at your browser in VR, I don't think that there's anything interesting to a non-enthusiast crowd at this present moment.
I have to agree with you that I don't think, as much as I adore gaming on VR, I don't think gaming is what's going to bring VR to the masses. I think it'll be something else. It'll be, I don't know, Facebook, virtual tourism, just, you know, something like that. Some type of application that we can't even conceive of right now.
A grandma sharing the room with her grandkids, you know, from 1,000 miles away, something like that.
All right. So kind of tying into that question, friend of the show, David at Upload VR, is our gaming editor. He asked us, what is missing the most from VR? What do you think, Joe?
I am a big fan of the kinds of games out there right now that do fully immerse you in that experience. And as I touched upon right before we transitioned to this, when you lose that, whether it's because of a lack of input option or just a poorly designed game, you know, maybe the visual fidelity isn't there or a screen door effect, I feel like what's missing the most from VR right now is a clear, concise message of, especially in Oculus, a clear, concise message of, this is what VR is as an experience. It includes these touch controllers or it doesn't. And there's a lot of argument to be made for they're going to further segment audiences, just like PlayStation Move might, those little waggle controllers, because if we're talking about giving developers incentive to develop for a wacky new technology, it's already a hurdle. But if you have three other tiny hurdles to get over, it's just that much more difficult to determine what your strategy is as a studio.
Blake, anything to add?
What's missing is people.
There you go.
Which I guess is related to the number of hardware units. But I think that we've kind of touched on this. But what I like most about the future of VR is that speaking with everybody at these different hardware makers and even the software makers is everyone has patience. And I have never experienced that before when dealing with business stories. It's, you get some PR speak of like, you know, we're in this for the long haul. We'll see how it goes. But you know that if they're not reporting a profit 2 quarters from now, it's over. But I sincerely believe that, these big companies are going to have the patience and they're not expecting it to, catch the fire and catch a mainstream audience right away. So I think it's missing people, but I think that the dominoes are starting to fall and they'll only accelerate.
I have to add something here. People are suspiciously like the Oculus Rift experience right now is suspiciously lonely.
Exactly.
You can't chat with the friends that you've added on Oculus Home. You look around in your Oculus Home space and it's this giant looks like it's this just massive loft in the middle of a Japanese garden or something. It's gorgeous and it's huge and there's no one else there. Well, and
to give you an even better gameplay example of that, when I was watching the Giant Bomb live stream, they were demoing Air Mech. They were
finding players.
Well, yeah. So they were attempting to get Palmer Luckey. They had arranged for Palmer Luckey to join them for a few matches, and whoever was playing couldn't really figure out the matchmaking system quite perfectly. So he hit, match me with someone, and a random person popped up, and they started having this kind of awkward conversation of like, oh, hey, yeah, my name's Tim from Giant Bomb. Oh, I'm Dave. And they started going back and forth like one of those, kind of awkward conversations you have with a random player. But it turned out the other player was actually a part of the Air Mech dev team. There was just no way to get that point across clearly. So it was like you got randomly matched with a developer of the game you're playing. And that just happened naturally through that random matchmaking system. And I was like, how few people are playing, or am I missing something here?
We've all said earlier, we really don't know. We don't know if 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 of these units have gone out. We just have no idea yet. We can certainly expect the player population to start increasing as each day goes by, though. All right, last question, guys. And this is from Michael Q. Thank you, sir. Is room scale VR a gimmick like Wii motion controllers or the Kinect? I can't see myself playing for hours in this format. And room scale VR is kind of a concept that was developed by Valve using their Lighthouse technology. And what the HTC Vive does is you place these two Lighthouse cameras, one in one corner and one in the opposite corner of the room. And it tracks your movement in up to a 15 by 15 foot space. Very, very accurately, whether you're turning around or lying down or on your stomach or, whatever. Super, super accurate tracking, one-to-one movement. And that's what allows you to walk across that icy ledge in Everest or physically pick up that bow in the lab or, dodge spaceship fire in that really cool, Galaga style, 3D arcadey thing that's in the lab. And it really you want presence. That's presence. It's, presence is being physically, feeling physically in that non-physical world. And so, Joe, I know you have something that you wanted to, contribute to this question, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's certainly something I'm interested in because it's that next biggest step, getting off of the couch and, walking through an experience as opposed to sitting down and just playing on a controller. And I saw examples of that were really good. Like the Paranormal Activity demo at GDC had old men who, you know, should by no means get scared at a fake presentation like this. They're not people who would naturally, like, you know, leap out of their seats in a theater, like ripping off the HTC Vive and like scaring the developer, being like, no, don't throw it to the ground.
Don't throw it. One girl did throw it. She like tossed that thing and ran.
And great. But where my concern grows is the more like narrative or even still horror based experiences, because they have this technology with that Vive. A company, Tecton Games, is creating a quote walkabout system that they're using for whatever game they're developing, and it looks like a horror game. You're walking through kind of an old abandoned house, and as soon as you're about to hit a wall, like inside your living room, and the video they have has this guy in kind of a very standard sized apartment living room, you can imagine about 10 feet wide. As soon as he's about to hit that barrier, a kind of fake blue wire wall pops up in the game, and it's a warning, you know, like, hey, don't walk any farther than this. You're going to smash your face. And so what they do is they press a button, they turn around, and the environment appears back where they were standing, but now they have an additional 15 feet to walk. So, okay. So the idea, and I'm watching this guy walk through a very scary, very well modeled house, and I'm just like, it's so jarring to have to turn around every 15 seconds. And also, I mean, unless it's a very secluded kind of horror experience, I suppose, what option is there to say like, hey, here's a monster, hide or run? There would be no such thing, because your natural inclination would be to run all the way back to wherever you started, which isn't a reality when you have a 10-foot living room. You're either going to walk into moments like, oh, I'm in a 10-foot by 10-foot room that looks really scary, I wonder what's going to happen, or the horror experiences are just going to be kind of pop out jarring jump scares that really don't push the limit of what we might be able to see with VR. I just don't like that idea that I can't flee a monster because of the limitations of where we're playing, you know?
Well, then, I mean, I think it goes back to the experience needs to be developed with that room scale VR technology in mind, right?
Yeah.
Like you can't have a walking simulator style game in VR, because that's just going to be disruptive.
But I mean, what about logistically? I live in New York. Our apartments tend not to be too big.
Exactly.
So, so logistically, you need, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think a 6 by 5.5 space is the minimum for the room scale VR stuff.
All right.
And which isn't, you know, it's a pretty small space, but it might also feel restrictive being in that small space. And the HTC has the chaperone system that's really interesting, because it will, you know, it maps out your room and it'll actually alert you, similar to the wall that Joseph was talking about. It'll bring up this like grid that will show you where your actual walls are and where your objects in your room are. Or you can like flip on a front facing camera on the Vive, and it'll kind of give you like this cool predator vision where it's like a heat map of the room around you. But yeah, like I totally get that concern, Joe. And I think it's just, you know, it has to be an experience that takes advantage of that room scale VR stuff, like the lab. Like, yes, I could absolutely be in those mini games for hours. And it's not because I'm walking, but it's because I have the freedom of movement to walk in a little bit of space, you know. Now something like Vanishing Realms, Vanishing Realms tackles this differently. It tackles it in two ways. And I don't know if anyone's read my preview, but it's basically like if a D&D game came to life. That's kind of what it feels like to play it. It is a, you know, an action RPG with some D&D elements, but I'm getting off topic. You can physically walk through those hallways, physically walk up to rings that are on a, you know, on a key ring and open doors and bend down and, you know, walk over and unlock chests. Or you can use they have like this blink system where you can kind of point the controller at a spot on the floor and then like teleport over to it to advance. So they've kind of tackled that in two distinct ways. And I think the teleportation works better because, like you said, it kind of sucks to be like instantly immersed in that world and you're walking along and then you go, oh, a wall. Well, crap.
Also, Dishonored's going to be real visceral when that blinking mechanic gets implemented.
Oh, man. When do you guys think, like, let me just ask you this before we wrap up and say goodbye. What game would need to be out right now on the Rift for you to plunk down that $600? What would it take?
Oh.
Like, it could be just a game you've never thought of or an existing property that was done perfectly on VR.
Like, of any property, just like a dream game? Yeah.
Yeah, just anything. Yeah.
I just looking at the shelf I've got right now, I'm thinking back to all the scary experiences I had in Alien Isolation. And the sense of presence that they achieved with the alien there, and they set out to make it feel so much larger than the aliens would feel in Colonial Marines. And even just playing on a screen, you get a sense that this beast is not only bigger than me physically, it's a force of nature that cannot be moved. And you put that into VR, and you get it right in your face. Oh, beautiful.
So what you're saying is you like heart attacks.
Yes, I'm young. I can take them.
What about you, Blake? Anything spring to mind?
Mostly just conceptually. You know, I think that I hadn't played games in a long time before the Wii came out, and that was something that I really got into. And part of it was because my girlfriend, now fiance, we played it together. So I think that if there's something that I could do with her, or when maybe the Touch comes out, if there's something that I could play with my brother out in Colorado. You know, something like that, I think, would be what's going to make me run to the fake non-existent store and shell out $600.
Right on. Well, hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to our first episode. I hope it wasn't too rough. We're kind of feeling this out, but, you know, we're always open to feedback. So let us know what you thought. Let us know what we can change or improve or what should stay the same. And I want to thank our very special guest, Blake Harris. Go check out his book, Console Wars. It really is an incredible read and an educational one at the same time, which is a rare thing. Read his work on Upload VR. He wrote a really, really in-depth article about the kind of an origin story of Lucky's Tale on the Oculus Rift. And Joseph, where would you like people to kind of find you, like one central place?
And you can find
anything, anything you want to pimp out.
You know, I just wrote a couple of things for Upload VR that you can probably still find in the previews area. But probably my most proud feature right now, coming off of GDC, of course, is the best student games of GDC. Myself being a recent college graduate in the last year, I took it upon myself to kind of reach out to some student developers from USC and New York Games Incubator Unit. And I interviewed some of the winners of that IGF Festival Awards ceremony at GDC. And they not only do their games deserve your recognition, but the spirit that they're carrying forward really, really resonates with anyone who just has a huge passion for it. So you can find that in Playboy. It's called Six Cool Student Games from GDC 2016.
Nice. And finally, I want to thank Cubby. You heard a little snippet of an amazing track called Overworld at the top of the show, and we're going to give you a little snippet of it at the end of the show as well. Just incredible kind of atmospheric chiptune-inspired music. It's actually one of my favorite albums of 2015. Honest to God, it's terrific. You can find them at cubby.bandcamp.com. Cubby is spelled K-U-B-B-I. .bandcamp.com. Guys, I think we're done.
Bye-bye.
Until next time, I don't know, clever catchphrase here.
we'll have a new batch of presents for you.
Oh, say that again.
And next time we'll have a new batch of presents for you.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Yay! Cool.
So should we? We have a sound clip for that, right?
Sure. We'll get one. Yeah, I'll have one.
Field of view. Field of view. You guys can use that royalty.
Do that. Do that again. Let us be quiet. Do it again. Do it again.
Ready? Here it comes. Let me play it. Field of view. Field of view. All right. Yeah, that's great.
Angel choir.
Totally gonna use that.